The Natural Nurse with Ellen Kamai and Dr. Z, Mondays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Right here on Progressive Radio Network. And we're so happy to bring you The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and that's every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time, although actually here at Progressive Radio Network, we are available for your listening and education 24/7. That means 24 days, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. All you have to do is go to progressiveradionetwork.com and click on archives. You can see a list of many of the excellent shows on Progressive Radio Network, including this show, The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And then once you click on the show of your choice, you will be able to listen and even download so many of the archived shows. What a great service to the educated healthcare consumer by tuning into Progressive Radio Network. And today, right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, we have Steve Cagney. Steve is a natural health and nutrition counselor who began researching and teaching food energetics in 1972. He teaches throughout the United States and Europe and continues to study traditional cultures and their dietary practices in remote parts of the world. And he hails to us today from Colorado. We're talking about his beautiful new book called Food Energetics, The Spiritual, Emotional, and Nutritional Power of What We Eat. So thank you so much for joining us right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Welcome, Steve.
Hi.
So I hear that you're on the line. That's good. Now, let's go back in history, because you're talking about something that you've been involved in for quite a while. In fact, I believe that you wrote this book originally in the 1900s, right around 1990.
Yes.
And it has been updated, and now we have a new copy that we're looking at right here.
Yes, it went from something like 86 pages to close to 300.
So that means you're still on a learning quest. But
yes.
What made you interested in something called food energetics way back when?
Well, you know, when I first started studying in college nutrition, it was kind of complex. You know, I was learning a lot about weights and measures and how much calcium is required every day, minimum daily requirements of this and that. And I also started to get into natural foods at that time, in the late 60s, actually, and started to look into traditional Chinese medicine. And the way they looked at food was so different from what I was studying in college. The way they understood it was more from the perspectives of energetics or energy. In other words, that food might make you consuming fats and proteins help make the body more warm. Eating lots of fruits and raw foods make the body more cold. And I started thinking, well, this is a very interesting way of looking at things. And I started to look at other cultures other than Chinese. I looked at, you know, in Persia, I looked in Peru, and looked at all these different places. And they all had the same concept. They understood food from a very personal perspective, as opposed to a you know, something far removed from them in a laboratory. And as I researched it more and more, I decided I'm going to go and visit some of these places and get into some of the tribal people's lifestyle and various things like that to discover what they know and how they view food and perceive it. So that's pretty much where it all started, and it just progressed from there. And you're right, it's a constant learning curve. It's just continuous.
Now, the thing is that, as you said, and it is such an interesting point, that we think that we are the preeminent knowledge source, and that the Western thought process of perhaps looking just at the chemistry of food is the latest word. But actually, that's the new kid on the block. As you found out, the traditional knowledge, and when I use the word traditional, I am really respectful of using the word traditional. For instance, when I'm referring to traditional medicine, what I mean is things that you're talking about, which are ancient folkloric traditions and ancient evidence-based. When I say evidence-based, it's because they have so much data, let's say Chinese medicine, showing that it works effectively with minimum adverse effects of any kind for literally thousands of years. Well, what we do in current culture could be called mainstream in terms of medicine rather than food. Let's say mainstream medicine, conventional medicine, allopathic medicine, which is sometimes loses a tremendous amount of knowledge. And don't forget, Steve, when those systems, when those traditional systems were developed, they did not have access to the idea of chemicals or chemistry in food.
Exactly. Their whole way of understanding things was based on two very common things that we all have, and that's observation and experience. They observed the cycle of a plant's life, the seasons, the life stages, reproductive cycles of animals that were being consumed, and what they ate, how much sunlight a particular plant needed, like fungi, for example, grow in the forest. They may need no sunlight. So that made a big difference in terms of how they understood that. And, of course, at some point in our remote past, someone went out there from some tribe somewhere and ate one of these hallucinogenic mushrooms and went back to the tribe in a very different state than they left. And they understood from that day on that that particular mushroom is what does this. And so if it's going to be used, it's going to be used either ceremoniously or not at all. Another tribal member, or maybe the same one, discovered another mushroom and died on the spot. And they had to go retrieve him. They realized that that mushroom is a no-no. Don't even go near that one. And so this observation and experience process has gone on for many thousands of years. And they have accumulated this knowledge, and every traditional culture has this knowledge of, or we might say food wisdom, as opposed to the chemical approach that we do today.
Chemistry. Oh, I like that, food wisdom. Now, of course, the chemical approach, if used in conjunction with this traditional knowledge, actually is excellent. For instance, as an herbalist, which I am, I love everything from collecting wild plants in the field and making them into such things as dried teas and tinctures, to understanding the botanical pharmacognosy, where we're actually looking at the molecular structure and how it interacts, for instance, at a membrane level. And I find that all those things can work together beautifully, enhancing your understanding and enhancing your awe about the order of nature. So they don't have to be, you know, one way or the other.
That's right. In fact, if one looks at all the traditional perspectives on food and some of the, what you call, biocultural qualities, which mean, you know, basically these expressions like food is heating or cooling or dry or wet. Some of these perspectives that are called biocultural perspectives are all, without exception today, being confirmed by modern nutritional science and chemistry. So those old sayings about, you know, a particular food enhancing brain function or helping one to concentrate and think, now we find through chemistry and nutrition, we find that, you know, omega-3 fatty acids are certain substances that support the brain and nervous system in terms of focus and concentration and so on. So all those foods in the past that were called this, like fish was called brain food, right?
Yes.
Many thousands of people, you know, all coastal people thought fish was brain food. And, of course, now we know that they're super high in omega-3s, and not all of them, of course, but generally speaking, we have that. And we have other nutrients that exist in there. So we have a confirmation from modern chemistry of, you could say that modern chemistry is catching up to ancient wisdom. So you're right. They do both support each other very well.
Yes, and we see that all the time. For instance, again, in herbal medicine, since that's my specialty, but the same is true, I'm sure, with food energetics, your specialty, they often state in folkloric history that a particular plant would be more effective if it's picked, and they'll say something like in the morning or during the full moon or after a rain, or something that has traditionally been passed down, and as you elucidated, that is usually through observation and then oral tradition. But when we test known chemical actives, amazingly enough, it always collaborates that ancient folkloric wisdom in that there will be a higher level or a more bioavailable level or form of a particular active nutrient if the plant is picked at the historically preferred time.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, I know you know this, but it may be new information for some of your listeners out there, and that is that there is a tremendous push for scientists and nutritionists and herbalists and so on to go into the rainforest right now and to gather this wisdom and these plants from the local people because, like you said, it is all being confirmed. So they don't want this knowledge to die. They want to maintain it. So there's a lot of scientific research going on in rainforests and various other parts of the world now where these traditional understandings are still available.
Yes, that's so true. And I do want to tell people that your book, Food Energetics, The Spiritual, Emotional, and Nutritional Power of What We Eat, is easily available, and there is so much information in here about how we can balance our system by paying attention to energetics and choosing our food wisely. Let's talk about the decline and fall of the concept of energetics.
Yes. Well, you know, first of all, we tend to think in the West and in modern times and civilized cultures, we tend to think that that nutrition and diet and health is rocket science, that we have to know all these little details and all these complicated things. Well, that's good for specialists like, you know, an herbalist or a doctor or whatever, but the average person doesn't need to know those kind of details. They just need to know what real food is. And that's where the decline of energetics began way back in the 40s, and it isn't even that long ago, because we have found now that through research that what we thought was the origin of agriculture began around 10 to 12,000 years ago, but more recent studies, research has shown it's going back about 20,000. And, you know, some of the studies in the Israel area of the Middle East had brought up grains and various types of pulses that were domesticated some 20,000 years ago. So this date keeps getting pushed back in this cycle of human and food interaction. But more recently, well, if we think about from 20,000 years ago to the present, we have maintained the very same principal foods in all cultures up until about 200 years ago when we started to process and refine foods on a mass scale. And most of that occurred in the 40s, you know, through preservatives and mass producing food. We thought we needed to do that, but, I mean, any good farmer today, organic farmer or biodynamic farmer, can tell you that easily you can produce massive amounts of food without these things. And you know, so it's all part of the game and everything. So the decline of energetics, that understanding, even our great-grandmothers pretty much understood the energetic process when you know, she told us to eat everything on the plate or told our parents to eat everything on the plate and everything. It was all part of that balance of the meal. That she understood. And like I say, it's only been until recently when food started to decline into something that wasn't real food anymore. Or it was a combination of real food masked through chemicals and preservatives to make it look better or more appealing, and colors and additives and so on. So we, you know, just recently then we've had this decline of real foods, and look at what has happened. My gosh, it's, you know, the decline of health in America and Europe and everywhere in the world, actually, through that have been subjected to this, you know, process of chemicalization and preservatives and everything. So
now I wonder where GMO fits into this. What happens to the energetics of the food, or has any testing been done? We're starting to see the adverse effects of eating genetically modified food, but it would be so interesting to see how someone who understands traditional ancient culture and understands food energetics could perhaps test or understand the change in energetics due to the genetic modification of foods.
Good point, because one of my earliest teachers had made a statement. He says, we can't change our food without changing our species. And it was a really profound statement, because that is exactly what will happen with this genetically modified food. When you're splicing spider genes into tomatoes and various things like that, you're combining the plant and animal kingdom in a way that has never been done. The importance of their mutual support in nature is one thing, but when you start combining genetics like that, you're going to end up with a whole different type of food that will be actually forced upon the present species and will inadvertently affect the next generation in some way, and I'm sure it's going to be some strange way. But human species has adapted to everything throughout history for many millions of years. So it will probably adapt, but it won't be the same species that we are dealing with today. In a matter of a few generations, if this genetically altered food takes hold, it could be a very interesting and maybe even frightening scenario for those of the human species that are still here.
Yes, it is. It certainly is. But let's go back into ancient times and look at some of these very specific understandings that they had. For instance, when we have ongoing habits in our eating, and sometimes those are bad habits. I know you have a chapter called Choosing Your Food, Habit, Appetite's Nemesis. What did you mean by that?
Well, yeah, appetite can often be our nemesis. You know, one of I forgot the guy's name, Batmadagin, a Middle Eastern author, wrote a book on water, and he had a really profound statement and he says that the human body does not recognize thirst, so like it does hunger. So 99% of the time, he says, when people are hungry and their appetite is ravenous, they're dehydrated. And, of course, a lot of this has been backed up scientifically as well through research. And so our appetite can be our nemesis sometimes in that way alone, just that, you know, we will respond by indulging and just eating whatever is in front of us as a result of a simple process of dehydration, when a full glass or two of water would have satiated that appetite extreme. The other thing with the appetite's nemesis is that we will tend to sabotage ourselves through repeated patterns in our diets and with food. I like to use this as an example of a friend of mine who used to eat all his food at a deli, and he became ill, and you know, it was always cream cheese and bagels and, you know, fast, quick food from the deli in New York. And he became ill over time, and he, of course, had seen people in New York and doctors and everything, and he came to the conclusion himself that it was the result of the way he was eating. But it was such a deep ingrained habit to do that he began to now go to the natural food stores and get bagels and cream cheese, of course all organic now and all natural, and you know, instead of drinking, you know, commercial sodas, he got a natural fruit juice, carbonated soda, and natural potato chips. So the pattern there didn't resolve any of his problems.
So you're saying even though he moved over to natural, we're still eating a high portion of high sugar food, high fat food. I mean, very often I'll see that. There may be breakfast cereals, and on the front, they look really hot and sexy, like they say organic all over the place, and they're showing you these whole grains growing in the field. But when you turn it around and read the ingredients, even if the first ingredient is perhaps organic whole wheat, the second ingredient is often sugar, which means there's a really high portion of sugar in that product. So while it's a step better, you're still staying within that, like you're talking about, habit, which really isn't leading towards better health.
Right, right. And the patterns, you know, the overconsumption, or all of the patterns that will be, first of all, when someone is not nutritionally satisfied, one will tend toward compensating by eating whatever is in front of them, or get on compulsive eating binges. And this is often the result of occurs with any natural diet, whether it's vegetarian, macrobiotics, or any of these diets out there. Whenever something is missing that was traditionally consumed, a good example is the demonized fat program that's been going on forever. People reduce fat to a minimum, yet fat, 95% of the brain is made up of saturated fats and so on. So fat is needed for so many functions in the body, on a cellular level all the way up to organ function. So to eliminate it just because we read something or some science comes out on it, it's a traditional food. Fat is a traditional food, all types of it. And that's the other thing. We will often replace that. People in consuming natural foods will often replace traditional oils, which are only a few: coconut oil, olive oil, hazelnut oil, sesame oil. Some of these oils that have been around for many thousands of years, and fats like that that have been used, are now being replaced by ones that were never used, like canola and soybean oil and safflower oil. And even flax oil. Now, that's a big bone of contention for a lot of people, where a lot of people will say, well, flax oil is mentioned in the Bible 15 times. That's right, it is. No, flax oil is not mentioned at all. I'm sorry. Flax is. And it's always in the context of tapestry and clothing and things like that, never in the context of food. So
I didn't know that. Boy, that's why I just love learning new things every day, too.
Yeah. You know, it's also a polyunsaturated. Well, we won't go into flax oil because that could go on forever. But it's interesting that we bring these things in as cash crops. It's an expensive oil, yet it's a really inexpensive cash crop. So whoever's behind it makes a fortune on this particular product, yet it's really not doing much.
Well, I do want to go a little bit more deeply since you brought it up, Steve, and I do want to tell our listeners that we're speaking here with Steve Cagney. But you know what? We are going to take a break right now. So when we come back, we will continue our discussion with author Steve Cagney about food energetics. You are listening to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right here on Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be right back with more. And welcome back once again. You are right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and thank you so much for joining us. You know, you can join us in person. If you get in touch, just go to naturalnurse.com, click on schedules, and you'll see the many kinds of classes and workshops that we have going on all over the country. And you're welcome to join us. For instance, we go outside and do herbal identification and medicine making. We go to Chinatown and take you to many of the traditional Chinese medical centers where they understand all about these energetics and tempos and rhythms that is part of the book that we're talking about today with author Steve Cagney. So either go to Facebook, The Natural Nurse. That's a great place to find out more. We have all our events listed, including our shows on Progressive Radio Network, or naturalnurse.com, and go to schedule to find out where we will be and when we will be in your area. Today we are with author Steve Cagney, and we're talking about food energetics, the spiritual, emotional, and nutritional power of what we eat. And he has a lot of very, very interesting concepts in here that you can use to help balance your system through the use, intelligent and traditional use of the energetics that are in different kinds of foods. Now, I was very interested in your chapter on tempos and rhythms. And that looks like, I mean, is that information that you yourself have come up with, such as alcohol having sort of a changing and irregular rhythm and acting as a mild stimulant initially, or are these things that are also taught in traditional systems?
Yeah, these are taught, and all I've done really is try to explain them more in a layman's terms, a really simplified terms. For example, alcohol we would place in a category of fermentation, fermented foods and beverages. So fermented foods tend to be have the energy of energetics of a rising type of energy, where fermentation occurs, bacteria is produced in massive quantities, and through this live kind of process of interaction between salt and various amino acids and chemicals and so on in the plants or whatever is being fermented. So alcohol is a process of fermentation in general. So that gives the upward type of energy that we call energetics, but the temperament of it, or the rhythm of alcohol, is that depending on the type of alcohol, some of it is done and processed very quickly. Others take, you know, are processing that for years before it's ready. So the result of it, it enters the bloodstream very quickly, so the energetics of it is more of a irregular rhythm pattern. It's not smooth, it's not easy, it just comes on, enters the bloodstream. So that's why, you know, but it doesn't make it bad. Every traditional culture has a fermented alcoholic type of beverage of some form that was used. So
well,
everything has a rhythm.
Yeah, it's very interesting how you even talk about, you know, for certain people, of course, are vegetarians, but some are not. So if people were going to, traditional people were going to view a chicken and see, most people have seen chickens in barnyards, they run around pretty quickly and they have a fast, irregular rhythm. And that would relate to using that kind of meat, perhaps, versus maybe eating a cow that's sort of much slower and sits around all the time.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a good point because, you know, every traditional culture has their version of chicken soup. And, you know, some of it is very simple and base, and others are more complex with the perfect right proportion of herbs and stimulants, spices in it or whatever. But nonetheless, everyone has their version. Whether you go Middle East, Southeast Asia, anywhere in Asia, anywhere, South America, wherever chickens are, and they've been around and been distributed for at least 8,000 years, they say. One of the earliest domesticated animals. And but the chicken soup, energetic properties of the bird, like you just mentioned, is active compared to a cow that just kind of slowly lumbers along and goes about its day grazing continuously. So that chicken soup had a medicinal quality among traditional people of helping people to improve from their illness and to get up and get active out of the bed, out of their illness bed where they were confined or for maybe days or whatever, being, you know, subjected to some kind of virus or whatnot. A hot chicken soup was what they gave them everywhere. So
yeah, I was interested to find out. Yes, we talk about that in Chinatown when we take groups to Chinatown to study traditional Chinese culture and traditional Chinese medicine, that Chinese mothers actually make chicken soup all the time, as do Jewish mothers. They're famous for it. So very large cultural decisions have been made, and it's interesting to see how they often are so similar.
Yeah, yeah, and that, and it's like, you know, you could use Michael Pollan's analogy of we're not controlling food. Food is controlling us.
Oh, that is in his book called The Biology of Belief, which I recommend to all my listeners. And, in fact, very recently I was invited to be the lecturer that presented before the presentation of that particular movie called The Biology of Belief. And the book is written by Michael Pollack, and he's featured in the movie as well. Very interesting flick that really does talk a lot about the things you cover in food energetics, Steve.
Yeah, that whole idea of everyone having this chicken soup for when you're ill instead of a beef soup or a lamb stew or some other animal, it is all based on the same reasoning or the same thought patterns of an energetic little animal that can help you get motivated. So chicken would be considered energetically a motivating food compared to a muscular building, robust type of food like beef or lamb.
Well, let's talk about a raw vegan diet, because a raw vegan diet is having rather, it sort of comes in waves in terms of having renaissance periods. I've been involved in whole food eating and whole food teaching since 1964, and during those many decades, I have seen that concept kind of come and go, you know, on and off, but right now it's having a renaissance. And how would that kind of eating reflect, they talk a lot about it being alkaline, but how would it reflect in terms of food energetics?
In terms of food energetics, when food is completely raw, well, first of all, there are no primate species on the planet. There are probably very few small monkeys that are 100% vegan. Whereas all other of the primates are omnivorous, eating small rodents, eating various bugs, eating, you know, other animals, and so on. But the raw foods diet will help anyone transition, especially someone coming from a major indulgence of saturated fats and processed foods and everything. So people often feel really great after about a month of consuming raw foods. But from an energetic perspective, this raw upward energy lacks in a grounding, stabilizing, centering energy that comes from cooked food and prepared foods and also animal products. It's interesting because it's often rationalized among raw fooders that, you know, we've only cooked our food for 10,000 years. Well, that keeps getting pushed back, you know, for agriculture for 10 to 20,000 years, but recently an article just came out that in the Middle East there was discoveries of cooking going back 1.9 million years. Now that's a major jump, you know. So things are changing all the time in terms of discovering of who we are and what we've done with food. So
that's true. And also, I think there's another book, perhaps it's called The Power of Fire, that talks about the link of an expanding intellect directly to the ability to cook food or the concept of beginning to cook food.
Right, right. So basically we don't have any human connection to a raw food diet as a tradition anywhere in the world. It's very similar to a vegan diet. There is no link to that. The closest we have are maybe some places in India where there is vegetarian diets that can go back some thousand years or so, but we don't have a raw vegan diet anywhere, with the exception of some small primates that are not human at all, little monkeys. But so it is interesting, and I think the healing aspects of it are short-lived, but they can be miraculous. I mean, I've witnessed some pretty amazing things in people that have done it, you know, from obesity to trimming down very quickly to, you know, just more energy. But inevitably, they were coming from the same place that people go come from when they approach any natural diet. Now, the interesting thing about going, changing one's diet is we tend to be extremists and creatures of habit in the West, and we tend to do things dramatically because we want quick results. We want that magic pill. So we want our diet, when we change our diet, we tend to want it tailored to us specifically. When the best thing anyone could do to adjust themselves and not have to go through extremes of compulsive eating and nutritional deficiencies and all the things that come about with modern diets. And that's one of the big ones, nutritional deficiencies, because sometimes when, especially with children, if they do these deficiency diets, natural diets, many of them pay for it the rest of their lives with stunted growth and bone loss and all kinds of things.
So, yes, and I, as a clinician, I definitely have seen that.
Yes.
I definitely have seen babies that have been raised by strict vegan parents have very slow growth patterns, have learning capacity deficiencies,
yes,
as they get older, are much smaller in size, have weaker bone structure. And then in adults, we've seen things like elevated homocysteine levels in two groups. And it's interesting because in your book, Food Energetics, the Spiritual, Emotional, and Nutritional Power of What We Eat, you talk a lot about balance. So we see imbalance both in people who eat a tremendously high junk food, heavy meat-based diet, particularly processed food diet, and now we're talking about the opposite end of the spectrum. So somewhere in between seems to be the perfect energetics. And in your book, it's very flexible because it can change for each person and it can change for each season and for different stages in life.
Yeah. I think the first thing that before, you know, my suggestions for people in general to get started on a healthy diet are to just start with real foods. Get all the stuff that isn't real out of the diet and replace it. Then that reduces any kind of compulsion for anything. Of course, there is habits. We know that, what was his name, Jacobson, whatever, who wrote that book on, can't think of it right this minute, but he wrote this book about how addictive elements are actually being put in processed foods so that we become addicted to those foods like McDonald's or whatever, you know. So sometimes it's a big transition to get out of these kind of addictions because they're intentionally put in there. But getting back to real foods prepared, traditional foods prepared in traditional ways is the key to getting anyone's diet sorted out. And of course, there's no
set diet.
You also
have a great section in some of the cooking methods that would tend to really increase the energetics of the food as well as maintain a high portion of the nutrients and even release some of the nutrients.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So that, I mean, there's a place for raw foods in everyone's diet. In fact, every culture without exception has something that we are, most of us have forgotten about for the last, you know, 50-100 years, and that's fermented foods. Now, they fermented all kinds of vegetables. In Germany, it's sauerkraut. In, you know, they're kosher dill pickles for the Jewish culture. There are, everyone's got their own version of some kind of fermented food, which was an instrumental part of their daily diet. And what did these foods do? They aid digestion. So when we're having our main meal without some fermented food, then we're asking for trouble, you know? Why not have a little bit of that, a tablespoon or two in the meal? It tastes good. It supports everything else, the assimilation and absorption of fats and proteins and everything else.
A great one to think about, I think, is horseradish.
Oh, that's a note, yes, absolutely, yeah. So there are so many varieties of these things that...
Now, what kind of energy would horseradish have? Obviously, it's pretty obvious to most people that it might be hot, pungent.
Yeah, it's hot. Yeah, it's hot and pungent. So anything hot and pungent has a dispersive energy. It releases tension, releases accumulation. So the fact that it's a root plant, it grows under the ground, means that it supports any kind of lower body functions. So we know that traditional peoples, when they think of leaves and roots, they look at them in different ways. Root plants absorb and assimilate for the whole plant. That's their role in nature. So if we were at a slow process camera, video cam, and we watched a carrot, for example, or horseradish, let's use horseradish, and we watched that over the process of the summer during its growth period, we would see it absorbing and assimilating all kinds of inorganic materials from the earth, water, micronutrients, all kinds of things. So its job is to absorb and assimilate, as are all roots. So when we consume that, traditional peoples understood that to be something that supports our process of absorption and assimilation, because that's what our intestine does, the small intestine. It absorbs and assimilates.
Well, that's great information, and there's so much. We can't even begin to scratch the surface on all the very interesting elements that you discuss, not only in detail, but in a way that is very easy for people to initiate these actions within their own food choices and emotional choices as well. So we're going to sign off because we're actually at the end of our time, believe it or not. It went so quickly. And thank you so much for being our guest. We have been listening to Steve Cagney talking about his book, Food Energetics, The Spiritual, Emotional, and Nutritional Power of What We Eat, right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we'd like to have your comments. Get in touch at naturalnurse.com on the web or at Facebook, The Natural Nurse. Until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, hoping that you and yours stay healthy.